If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Get it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the cock. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Line engine, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a monthly podcast alternating fortnightly with its stablemate, the Martian Drive-In Podcast. Paleo Cinema looks at movies more than 20 years old in a wide range of genres and tries to find the cool, obscure or forgotten cinema of the past and brings it to your attention. Feedback is important, so please leave reviews on iTunes, email feedback, either written or MP3 attachment, to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru with a K at gmail.com. Or if you are in the USA, you can leave voicemails on area code 206-203-3299. This podcast contains coarse language and adult concepts, so you know it's going to be good.
Hi, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 104. My name is Terry Frost, and this time I'm looking at a couple of movies by Sean Connery. I'm doing two movies that he did in the mid-1960s that aren't Bond-related and that show the start of Sean Connery expanding as an actor. One successful to a great extent, the other one less so. But anyway, how is everybody? We're doing kind of good here. Winter's still here, which sucks a lot. The chaos that is Australian politics continues. I'm still doing the radio gig, which is fun. Recently, we did a couple of very interesting films. I did Wake in Fright, the Australian film, and The Adventures of Barry McKenzie. Now, we've had a week's hiatus where I'm not doing anything this week, but on the good side, the next movie that I do for the radio gig will be The Maltese Falcon, so I'm really looking forward to doing that with Ivor, and it's a lot of fun. But in other movie-related stuff, I did pick up a couple of really nice Daybill movie posters, the Australian lithograph Daybills that I really enjoy. I got one for The Bad and the Beautiful, my favourite movie ever, and I got one for the 1940 Thief of Baghdad, which is really a cool find. But I paid a little over market for both of them. I went to an antiques warehouse, and the guy there has literally thousands of them. And unfortunately, I didn't have money to buy them all. Instead, I chose two and paid a little bit of money for those, which I really did enjoy acquiring. The other movie-related thing is my mate Ivor Cole up in Darwin, with whom I do the radio, sent me down a whole bunch of really interesting bits and pieces, movie-related he had. He's got an original photograph of Marlene Dietrich from A Foreign Affair, which is a Billy Wilder movie she did in the late 1940s. Marlene Dietrich in a kind of bombed-out house she's living in the movie, which I kind of like. I did also get a bunch of interesting little bits and pieces from him, including movie tickets from way back when, one of which is for Cinerama Holiday, which was one of those great big Cinerama blockbuster show kind of movies that they put out in the 1950s. So I've got an original movie ticket from that with Cinerama Holiday on it, and a few other little bits and pieces. I got a row of tickets for the 1978 Sydney Film Festival, which was kind of interesting. They've got that very dated typography to them, but it was really nice of Ivor to send me those, and I do treasure them. I'm going to find a way to frame a bunch of these movie tickets he's given me and put them up on the wall just as a little extra movie-related decoration around the place. And he also gave me a few different movie-related books. I got the book of an Australian film called Journey Among Women. I did get the book that Three Coins in the Fountain's based on, which is a kind of chick flick movie from the 1950s, and a couple of others which were kind of a nice gift in a sense. And I also got an interesting book called Image on the Art and Evolution of Film, which is photographs and articles on silent movies and how silent movies were made, which is really interesting. Silent movies, I don't know enough of the history of. I know pretty much what everybody knows about them, but I'm going to look forward to reading through this book. It's quite a large, it's like trade paperback size or maybe a bit bigger, but I am going to look forward to reading that and just kind of increasing my knowledge of silent film in a good way. As far as movies I've seen lately, I'm just going to go into my miso. There hasn't been anything really spectacular which has floated my boat lately. I haven't been out to the cinema for a while. Tended to kind of take things easy as the weather's a bit cooler. And I know it's not cold compared to some other places in the world, but for us it's pretty cold. I did see a documentary series which I recommend. There's 7 episodes to it if you can find it on BitTorrent. It's called British Film Forever. It dates from about 2007, but there are 7 episodes, each of which looks at a different aspect of British cinema. One's about science fiction and horror, one's about comedy, one's about social realism, so you get all those kitchen sink dramas in it. Really good little piece to check out and put in your collection too if you collect documentaries about film the way I do. I did see a movie which I saw for the musical acts in it. It's a film from about 1943 called Reveille with Beverly, which was the first film performance by Frank Sinatra. But apart from that, it's got people like the Mills Brothers, and it's got Ella Mae Moore singing Cow Cow Boogie and all those kind of really cool retro musical acts from the middle part of the 20th century. And I did enjoy watching that. I watched half of another movie, The Fastest Guitar Alive, with Roy Orbison as his only starring role in a movie. And it's very bad. I mean, the premise is pretty stupid and it's pretty bad. And so I really don't recommend people see it unless you're an incredibly diehard Roy Orbison fan. Great singer. And there are a couple of nice songs he does in the movie. But as an actor, he is not the best person for the job. Let me have a look here. What else have I seen? I did watch The Last Dinosaur with Richard Boone in it, that kind of weird Japanese-American hybrid with all the really bad dinosaurs in it, which I don't... Richard Boone was quite elderly. I think it may be one of his last film roles in this one, and he's playing a kind of studly billionaire. And maybe he's racked up a few too many birthdays to play that effectively, but someone had mentioned it. I think B Movie Cast did it a while back, amongst other people. So I thought I'd check it out, and it was mildly amusing, but nothing really terrific there. But apart from that, there's nothing that I've been watching that really floated my boat. But I'm looking forward to a couple of things. I am going to see The Dark Knight Rises, and I'll probably go out at some stage and see the Spider-Man movie. I'm not sure when, but I will get to see that. I still haven't seen Prometheus, but I think I'll wait for DVD or Blu-ray on that one. I'm not sure whether I'll buy it or whether I'll rent it or what'll happen, but in some manner I'll see the movie and then I'll be able to make an informed opinion about the quality or otherwise of it. But nothing. Ernie Borgnine died too. I forgot to mention Ernest Borgnine died. Great actor. Somebody I know corresponded with him because he was also a stamp collector. And he was a stamp collector for all of his adult life, and he was very well known in the philatelic world for being a stamp collector, amongst other things. But of course, he's one of those great character actors that can do comedy or drama equally well. He can play a menacing, sadistic fucker in movies like Emperor of the North and From Here to Eternity, and then go on to do McHale's Navy and a few other bits, and a kind of slyly comic role recently in Red with Bruce Willis and Helen Mirren in it. So he'll be missed. Ernie Borgnine, great actor. I really like him a lot. He's one of those character actors that you always assume is going to be there. High quality stuff, but Unfortunately, he had racked up a few birthdays. The only actor I know that's old, that's still alive and as old as Ernest Borgnine was, he was about 95 when he stepped on the rainbow, is probably Eli Wallach, who hasn't worked in a couple of years, but he's still around pumping. And, of course, we love Eli Wallach for things like The Magnificent Seven. So there were a couple of other people who died recently. I'm just going to check that out too, because I probably should name check them and recommend a work or two of the people who recently died. It's an interesting thing. Sometimes you discover people because of their death notices, which is sad, but on the other hand, it is quite useful to discover the things, the movies in particular, that you really aren't that familiar with. Let's see. Richard Zanuck died, American film producer, did Jaws, Driving Miss Daisy, Road to Perdition. He's died today, in fact. Let me see what else he's done in his filmography. Pretty good run of things. Let's have a look. Mulholland Falls, Deep Impact, Rules of Engagement, the 2001 Planet of the Apes, which he's probably not proud of, Clash of the Titans, as I said, Driving Miss Daisy, Neighbours, The Island, Jaws 2, The Iger Sanction. He did Spielberg's first feature film, Sugarland Express. So he has died. But there was somebody else. I'm trying to find out who that really I liked a lot. Of course, Andy Griffith. And I did him in a previous Paleo Cinema. You might want to go back and listen to the one about A Face in the Crowd. And Andy Griffith, I didn't particularly like him playing the sheriff in the Andy Griffith Show and those kind of things, but I did like him in that character role, The Face in the Crowd. It's the, even though it was his first cinematic role in any way, it's the one I really like him for. I think he had a rawness to him and a kind of vitality and a sly horniness in that role that really didn't let me engage with him in anything he did subsequent to that. Even though, he did, you know, the Andy Griffith Show, he did a really interesting little series, I think in the 70s, called Salvage, where he plays a junk man who decides to go to the moon to pick up all the junk that the Apollo missions left there. And, of course, people who are a lot older than me know him from Matlock. But, yeah, an interesting actor, apparently a nice guy too, which is always a plus. I hate really liking an actor as an actor and then finding out that they're total pricks. It's the George C. Scott phenomenon. You like George C. Scott as an actor, but he beat up every woman he ever fucked. But anyway, on that wonderful note, I am now going to take a break. And when I get back, I'm going to talk about one of the two movies that we're doing this time around. And I haven't even told you what they are, even though we're almost 13 minutes into the podcast. The first movie I'm going to do is called A Fine Madness, with Sean Connery, Gene Seberg, Joanne Woodward, and Patrick O'Neill in it. An interesting diversion in the career of Sean Connery. The second movie I'm going to do is a nice, gritty British war film called The Hill from the mid-1960s, which has a great male ensemble cast in it and quite a brutal story to it. And as it's Bastille Day today, Vive la France and all that kind of thing, I'm going to be playing interstitial French music this time around.
Je ne sais pas si l'âne est de plus blonde, mais de plus belle, il n'en est pas pour moi. Elle est vraiment toute la joie du monde, ma vie commence dès que je la vois. Et je fais oh, et je fais ah, c'est si bon de partir n'importe où, bras dessus, bras dessous, en chantant des chansons. C'est si bon de se dire des mots doux, des petits rien du tout, mais qui en disent long. En voyant notre mine ravie, les passants dans la rue nous envient. C'est si bon de guetter dans ses yeux un espoir merveilleux qui me donne le frisson. Ça vaut mieux qu'un million, tellement, tellement c'est bon. Vous devinez quel bonheur est le nôtre. Et si je l'aime, vous comprenez pourquoi. Elle m'enivre et je n'en veux plus d'autre, car elle est toutes les femmes à la fois. Elle me fait oh, oh. Elle me fait ah. C'est si beau de pouvoir l'embrasser et puis de recommencer à la moindre occasion. C'est bon de jouer du piano tout le long de son dos, tandis que nous dansons. C'est inouï ce qu'elle a pour séduire, sans parler de ce que je ne peux pas dire. Et c'est si bon quand je la tiens dans mes bras, de me dire que tout ça, c'est à moi pour de bon. C'est si bon. Et si nous nous aimons, cherchez pas la raison. C'est parce que c'est si bon. C'est parce que c'est si bon. C'est parce que c'est trop bon.
That was Yves Montand with a version of C'est si bon that predates the Eartha Kitt version, so I just thought I'd go back to earlier sources the way we often do here at Paleo Cinema. The first movie we're going to talk about is a 1966 Warner Brothers film, A Fine Madness, starring Sean Connery, Joanne Woodward, Gene Seberg, and also Patrick McNeil. This is a really odd movie in a really odd time in the career of Sean Connery. Now, you've got to remember, this is 1966. Bond mania is at its absolute peak. The movie that Sean Connery did just before this film was Thunderball, and it went ballistic. Really, he was the biggest box office star in the universe at the time. And, of course, that came with a downside. Partly, his privacy went totally out the window, and there's a lot of media from the time saying that Sean Connery was railing against it. He's a bit of a maverick, bit of a loner. Didn't think that because he was an actor in cinema that his personal life should be infringed on by the public or by the paparazzi and the journalists and all the bottom feeders that go along with those people. So, here's the problem. Connery really wanted to change his image, and so he wanted to do other projects that are a bit different. The choice of movies he did in between the James Bond films tells a bit of a story about this. I'll just go through a list of the films that Connery did in between each James Bond film, just to give a bit of an indication about that. He did Dr. No and then From Russia with Love back to back in 62 and 63. Then he did a movie with Basil Dearden called Woman of Straw, starring Gina Lollobrigida, which has a pretty good cast. Ralph Richardson, Connery, of course, Johnny Secker, Lawrence Hardy, and a few others. Now, and then he went on to work for Hitchcock. He did Marnie with Hitchcock with Tippi Hedren, Diane Baker, and people like that. Then he went on to Goldfinger, of course, which is very big. Then he did the second movie that we're going to talk about this week, The Hill, with Sidney Lumet for MGM. He did Thunderball, of course, and then he went on to do A Fine Madness. He actually did a documentary in between Thunderball and A Fine Madness called The Incredible World of James Bond, but most of it was just bits and pieces from his films. After this, he did You Only Live Twice. He did Shalico, a very weird western with Edward Dimitrik, in 68. The Molly Maguires in 69, which is a very rough and tough film. The Red Tent, he did with Peter Finch, Claudia Cardinale and Hardy Krueger in 69. Then there's the skip to the Anderson tapes in 71, again with Sidney Lumet. And then, of course, he did Diamonds Are Forever. So there's some really interesting interstitial projects there for Sean Connery to do. And A Fine Madness is probably the most ambitious one, but not necessarily the best. In the film, Connery plays a mad poet called Samson Shillitoe, who the movie is actually based on a novel by a guy called Elliot Baker. I've got a copy of the novel here. It's one of those kind of zany comedy kind of pieces, which sometimes work, sometimes don't, but whichever way you go, age kind of badly and really aren't necessarily, you know, as smart as the people who make them think they are. So Connery plays Shillitoe, who basically mad poet. He's married to a guy, a lady called, not a guy. What did I say, guy? He's married to a woman called Rhoda, a waitress played by Jeremy Woodward. And he's a loose cannon. He's working for a kind of carpet cleaning company. And Shillitoe, amongst his other faults, and he does have a number of them, including not paying alimony to a previous wife, instantly seduces any woman that takes his fancy. So there's a little bit in an office building where he seduces a kind of very tightly wound and buxom a secretary in an office building called Miss Walnicki, played by Sue Ann Langdon, in quite a little nice little comedy piece. And he's just he's kind of sexually voracious, takes no responsibility for anything except his art, and he's only ever published one book of poetry, which sold 178 copies, but it was very well regarded critically. There's a lot in it, so there's evidence that the guy's a genius, but he just hasn't reached the saturation point you need to have that recognized by the masses. And he, you know, he's basically a loose cannon wherever he goes. And he's impulsive rather than thoughtful. All of his rational and cognitive thought goes into his poetry. He neglects his wife, of course, and he's betraying her sexually every way he can. He takes no responsibility for his alimony to his previous wife. He's dodging a summons server, played by John Fiedler, who was the voice of Piglet in Winnie the Pooh, small, bald character actor. And it's interesting seeing Connery in this role for a few reasons. I'll just play a little bit of a clip of Samson Shillitoe doing a reading to a ladies who lunch kind of gathering of artistic wannabe women in a ladies group.
Once upon a time, a boy wrote, "Hail to thee, blithe spirit," and they kicked him out of school. And a man wrote, "Here I am a poet that doth drink of life as lesser men drink wine. Him they locked in a cage." Oh, and another man wrote, "Put them all together and they spell mother." Him they gave respect, reverence, money, money, money.
What's wrong with a poem to mothers? I happen to be a mother.
Briar, briar, limber lock, 12 geese in a flock. The old ones ride the young ones' backs, and they can't get over the chimney stacks.
What's that supposed to mean?
They may stop passing the buck to babies.
Of course, that particular reading doesn't end well. And Connery is miscast in this movie big time. It really doesn't work. You need somebody with Connery's intensity, but with something different. It's not the fact that Connery was playing James Bond and people could only see him as James Bond that was the issue with this particular movie. It's that you can see him trying to stretch himself as an actor. There's no doubt about that, but I don't think the script holds together very well. I think that the film only got made because Connery wanted to make it in that sense. He was promised he could do two films in between the Bond ones, and those two films ended up being, at the time, The Hill and A Fine Madness. The Hill was widely respected and won BAFTA awards, but A Fine Madness was his next choice because he wanted to stretch his acting muscles at something totally different than Bond, and he did. But the critics at the time were scathing about this one. Let me read a little bit from it. Leonard Mosley in the Daily Express said, "Sean Connery crashes from scene to scene like a mixture of Brendan Behan and Dylan Thomas, well pickered by the third bottle of the evening. But the boorish behaviour lacks the compensation which made Behan and Thomas tolerable to their friends, even in their worst moments. The sense of imagery, the power with words, the artistic vision, the fact that they were poets. In this film, Connery not only looks like a clod, he is a clod, and that means he isn't funny or touching either. If he wants to be funny, let him stick to the Bond films and play the fantasy straight. We'll do the laughing." So, yeah, that kind of stuff would really gutting as far as reviews are concerned. And it was kind of, the people making the Bond films, of course, liked the fact that this movie failed because it meant they could get Connery back. And It's a real artistic failure, though it does have interesting people in it, and it does kind of have echoes of other better works to it. Joanne Woodward does her best playing the kind of New York working class wife kind of role. She yells and rants and gives as good as she gets with Connery's Shillitoe in there, but it's kind of like nothing she says makes a difference to him except right at the end, which has got a very kind of Hollywood upswing at the end, literally an upswing. And but yeah, she does a good job of it. Jean Seberg's a bit lost in this film. She really does. She was going through a bad time in her life at the time. She was, and there's no ambiguity about what's occurred. She was being hounded by the FBI because she supported the Black Panther movement and a number of other things, and she was part of a counterintelligence program that the FBI did. They admitted as much after she died, where they basically harassed her until ultimately she allegedly committed suicide, though there is some doubt about that. Her life was made hell by these people, and A Fine Madness was made at a time when that was starting. There are some other interesting actors in the film as well. Patrick O'Neill, people might remember him from a few different things. He did a kind of Eurospy thing called Matchless. Let's see what else he was in. Just checking out the film stuff. He's in The Kremlin Letter. He played the main spy in The Kremlin Letter. I remember saying when I reviewed that on Paleo Cinema that he was a bit miscast because he was slightly too old for the role. He was in The Stuff, the Larry Cohen film, which I may do on a future episode of the Martian Drive-In podcast. He was in Castle Keep with Burt Lancaster, which is a very metaphysical World War II movie. He did a film that I kind of like, Chamber of Horrors, which is almost like a remake of House of Wax. In a way, he was in King Rat with George Segal in 65. So, you know, he's a good jobbing actor there. And he plays the husband of the character played by Jean Seberg, who is, as all women are, seduced by Samson Shillitoe, and probably one of the first users of a jacuzzi in cinema history. So we've got him in there. Colleen Dewhurst, a good Canadian actor, I believe. She has been in any number of things. Yes, she was Canadian, so I was right about it. She was born in Quebec. She was in a number of fine movies as well. Let's see what she was in. She was in The Cowboys, where John Wayne got killed. She was in A Fine Madness, of course. Let's see. She was in another John Wayne movie, McHugh. What a Stranger Calls. You'll know her face when you see her. Kind of, she was in her 40s at the time, but nonetheless, she too, her character too, was seduced by Shillitoe. Clive Revel, a New Zealand actor that who people might have seen in a number of films playing kind of broad character roles, even though he didn't. He was in movies like The Assassination Bureau and The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. He was the main psychic investigator in The Legend of Hell House, which is another movie I do want to do on a future podcast. A very eerie ghost story thing, which holds up very well as a companion piece to The Haunting. And since then, he's now doing voiceovers and voice work and things. Let's see what else. So let's see who else we've got there. Jackie Coogan, Uncle Fester's in there for a little bit. Sorrel Book, who people might remember from The Duke of Hazzard playing Boss Hogg, is in there. And Werner Peters, interesting guy, because he had his start in crimmy movies, the German crimmy movies in the late 1950s and 1960s. He's in Scotland Yard versus Dr. Mabuse and 36 Hours and kind of spent his career playing Nazis. Oddly enough, he was German, so that's not a big stretch for people. Died at the age of 52 of a heart attack because, as he shows in A Fine Madness, he gained a bit of weight, even though he's much leaner in the crimmy movies he did earlier on. But Werner Peters is in it, and there's not too much else to say about this film. I like the fact that Connery tried to do something different with this and tried to play a mad, drunk poet. But I really think that it's one of those ones you can admire the effort, but the results don't really kind of live up to it. And nonetheless, if you're interested in the career of Sean Connery and the works of Sean Connery, you can see him trying to stretch himself, but there is a saving grace in his acting in this film. And that's the fact that it's an incredibly physical acting role. He runs around, he leaps over things, he dances on the Brooklyn Bridge and kind of walks along outside the footpath above the traffic and things like that. There's a physicality that he brings to this role which is consistent with the physicality he brought to the Bond role. And I kind of like that. It's nice. Mad poets are usually kind of slow-moving drunks, but Connery's mad poet is intensely emotional all the time. And the most interesting bits of his acting in this film are the bits when he's not moving, when he's reacting to things, when he's waiting for the women to introduce him at their little at the little speech he gives at the women's club. Drinking champagne and looking like a trapped animal who doesn't really want to do this but needs the money. And it's quite broad acting, that part, but nonetheless it is interesting. And there's a lot of good location shooting in New York, so you see a lot of New York in the 60s, particularly Lower East Side and places like that. But I'm trying to find nice things to say about this film, but really, ultimately, it's a failure. Connery was obviously, as I said, scathed by the film, and went on to do didn't do a lot of comedy after that. I don't think he was incapable of comedy, but I think you would have had to have him playing a James Bond type, but mocking the tropes of that, and that never really occurred in his career. That's about all I'm going to say about A Fine Madness. The book isn't a bad read. I dipped back into it. I had read it years ago, but I dipped back into it. And it's not a bad read. It's very kind of consistent with the kind of light, fluffy comedies of the time. Oh, there is something else to say about the film. I apologise. He goes to a psychiatrist, played by Patrick O'Neill, and there are a bunch of other psychiatrists there, including Vanna Peters and Colleen Dewhurst. And there are bits of that parallel strongly parts of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And it goes to places where One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest went. Now, having said that, you think, okay, well, you know, this is before the Jack Nicholson One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, so maybe they stole from him. No, it's the other way around. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was written in the early 60s. This book was written in the mid-60s. And by this stage, by the time the book and the movie of A Fine Madness came out, there'd already been a stage production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest starring Kirk Douglas, which got very good reviews. So they borrowed the lobotomy subplot from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and tweaked it within the kind of movie this is and the kind of book that Elliot Baker's A Fine Madness is, to not have quite the same results as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But they make an interesting parallel in the way that the same rough plot can be handled two different ways for two different purposes. There is a little extra bit there. That quote that Connery does, "Wire Bri Limber Lock," is actually a different quote than he quotes there. The quote itself, I've just found out, which is rather interesting, is, and he said, doing his best poet's voice, "Wire Bri Limber Lock, three geese in a flock. One flew east, one flew west, one flew over the cuckoo's nest." So there is a direct reference in the movie of A Fine Madness to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I'm quite glad I just figured that out. So there's a little extra value added regarding this kind of failed experiment of a film. So I'm going to take another break, and when I get back, we're going to talk about the more interesting of the two films that Connery did during this period of time, being the Sidney Lumet black-and-white war film, The Hill.
Yes.
Says, plate.
The Fatherland must rule
course, that was the best rendition of La Marseillaise ever done, which was from Casablanca in 1942. And I thought I'd throw that in there for the usual Bastille Day reasons. Now, The Hill. This is a fucking brutal film. And it has in it a cast of what our friends over at the GG, TMC, and Hammockers, and other podcasts of renown, call Magnificent Bastards. Now, I'm going to give you a bit of an idea about the cast in this film, which, before I even tell you anything about it, if you don't know about it. You got your Sean Connery, Harry Andrews, Ian Bannon, Alfred Lynch, Ossie Davis, Roy Kinnear, Jack Watson, Ian Hendry, and Michael Redgrave. They are in this movie, Magnificent Bastards, and this is probably one of the strongest anti-war films and one of the more interesting roles that Connery did in his career. Now, I'm just folding pages and rustling paper here, so excuse me. Basically, it's a war film, 1965, directed by Sidney Lumet. It's set in a British Army prison in North Africa in World War II. It's a British Army glasshouse in the Libyan desert. I'm reading from Wikipedia and paraphrasing slightly as I go. Prisoners are convicted of service offences such as insubordination, being drunk whilst on duty, going AWOL or petty theft, are subject to repetitive drills in the blazing desert heat. The arrival of five new prisoners slowly leads to a clash with the camp authorities. One new NCO guard who has just arrived employs excessive punishments, which include forcing the five newcomers to repeatedly climb a man-made hill in the centre of the camp. When one dies, a power struggle erupts between the brutal Staff Sergeant Williams, played by Ian Hendry, humane Staff Sergeant Harris, Ian Bannon, the Regimental Sergeant Major, Harry Andrews, and the camp's medical officer, played by Michael Redgrave, as they struggle to run the camp in conflicting styles. That's basically the bottom line of it. And, yeah, this film is brutal. The Hill itself is a magnificent piece of construction and the central image of the whole film. But I'll just play a little bit of the audio as the RSM, Regimental Sergeant Major, played by Harry Andrews, reads the riot act to the new guys coming in there, played by, Ossie Davis, Roy Kinnear, Sean Connery, Alfred Lynch, and Jack Watson.
Right, let's have your names. You, 132, Private McGrath, sir.
You, 736, Private King, sir.
929, Private Stevens, sir.
You,
824, Private Bartley, sir.
421, Trooper Roberts, sir.
You're Roberts, eh?
Yes, sir.
Roberts?
Sir.
Your commanding officer gave you an order. He ordered you to fight. So you knocked his teeth out. Is that right?
Sir.
Is that all you've got to say?
Sir, it's all I want to say.
See that hill?
I noticed as I came in.
We built it special. A few tons of sand and rock and a lot of labor and sweat. The prisoners built it.
Well, that's marvelous, sir. It's a great construction feat.
Something tells me you're going to get to know it well.
I don't want any special privileges.
It's hot on that hill. Hot.
I fancied there's some snow on the top when I came in.
Dead set on having a go at it, aren't you?
Oh, I can do without it, sir, but I think you've got other plans for me.
This is a really good movie. I've actually got the novelization of the movie, which was written by Ray Rigby, the guy who wrote the play, along with somebody else called R.S. Allen. And it does play a little bit like a play, even though they did have a large set that was built in Andalusia in Spain. They actually filmed a lot of it in Spain, including the 35-foot-high hill, which is very central image to the movie. And one of the things Sidney Lumet did was he got his cast, the guys who were playing the prisoners, together and asked them to run up and down the hill as many times as they could. Roy Kinnear, being a short, round actor, British actor, he died on, doing the remake to The Three Musketeers. He fell off a horse. But anyway, when they were filming the movie, he collapsed going over the hill, and he wanted them to do it six times. And even Connery tore a tendon in his leg while he was running up and down the hill. And it's brutal. There are some long shots of people doing the hill, the actors doing the hill. They have a couple of crane shots where the crane, the camera pivots from a viewpoint near the top of the hill onto the actors running up and down the other side while carrying packs in a lot of cases and going up and down the hill and really sweating with it. You can see that this is a daunting task. It's very hot out in the desert, of course, and the hill's covered in loose sand, so climbing up almost a sand dune and down the other side is a brutal punishment, particularly for people who asked to do it repeatedly in full gear. And there's also a very telling scene where Staff Williams, played by Ian Hendry, goes out at night time and runs up and down the hill himself just to test himself. He's a very interesting character. In fact, I'll go through the characters. Harry Andrews, Regimental Sergeant Major, is a larger-than-life character. He really is. He runs the place. The commandant of the camp basically lives in town, sleeps with a hooker. You see him paying the girl he's lying in bed with, and it's one of the only two women you see in the whole film. Each morning as he gets up, does a quick inspection tour and heads back into town. So he's not there much of the time. The medical officer, played by Michael Redgrave, you get the impression that he's not a very good doctor at all, and that he kind of ticks off that a whole bunch of the prisoners are fit for duty when they're not. And ultimately, when one of the five dies of heat exhaustion, it comes to a head, and the character played by Michael Redgrave, who's never given a name, really has an epiphany and really decides that he's got to make a stand. And that's one of the interesting things about it. And so Harry Andrews' character, getting back to him, you know, large sense of humour, loves being in the army. He's regular army, loves being in the army, loves the camaraderie of it, has this mission to break the prisoners so he can build them up again as soldiers. What he ends up doing is building them up again. There's a scene towards the start where two prisoners are released, and the immense relief these guys have getting out of the place and getting away from under the thumb of the regimental sergeant major is quite interesting. He thinks that what you've got to do to rebuild human beings is to break them and then rebuild them. And of course, this works with some people in some ways, but it doesn't work with everybody, as the movie shows. The character played by Ian Hendry is interesting too. He's an ex-prison guard in England who joined the army and was asked to be shipped out to one of the prison camps because the prisons in England were being bombed. So basically there's an underlying streak of cowardice in this character. But there are a couple of things about him. He's a very driven man. There's a scene where him and Harry Andrews have a drinking competition, and he falls off his chair. Harry Andrews wins. So Harry Andrews' character staggers back to his room, falls into his bed, falls off his bed, and passes out. And Ian Hendry's staff, Williams, goes out to a large water tank, dips his head in the tank, staggers back, grabs a bottle and a couple of glasses, and then goes into the Sergeant Major's room, offering him a nightcap as if to tell him that he's better than the Sergeant Major, which sets up one of the tension dynamics in this film really well. And of course it is Staff Williams who runs the men up and down the hill to break them, mostly because Roberts, played by Sean Connery, has picked him at the very start for somebody who's gutless, essentially, and who can only function in positions of power to hide his own cowardice. And that becomes the main engine of the movie, that hatred that Williams has for Roberts, and the fact that Williams wants to run the camp. He knows that the RSM is running the camp, but he actually wants to run the camp because he has a need to brutalize other men. It's an incredibly deep and dark movie, and Ray Rigby, who wrote the play, spent some time in prison camps himself. He was not particularly a good soldier, but he spent two stretches in this kind of a camp himself during World War II, and later on went on to write about his experience. He also wrote a lot of things for television as well, but this is kind of his main achievement as a writer, speaking firsthand from the prisoner's point of view about this particular set of circumstances. And there's just some fantastic acting in here. Connery is extremely good in the movie. He's a career soldier himself, in the character Roberts. He knows what everybody in there is about because he's seen their type in the army before. You can quote the King's regulations word perfect, so he knows what his rights are as a soldier and as a prisoner, and he knows when they're being abused, so he isn't reluctant to stand up and say it. And his character again is interesting too, because he punched out a superior officer when that officer ordered him to take his men on basically what was going to be a suicide mission. He refused to do that. He knew they wouldn't gain anything from doing it. And he decked the guy and broke his teeth. So, again, you set him up as a kind of anti-hero, but also as somebody who's done the right thing and suffered for it. And Connery is very good in it. Ozzie Davis is the other character in the movie who's really impressive. An African-American actor playing a guy from the Caribbean who has British citizenship, and therefore, as a black soldier, is able to be imprisoned with white soldiers by the British Army. And he really does have an interesting character arc. He's a kind of happy-go-lucky character at the start, but he does kind of go mad, and he plays to his strengths, which are the white man's fear of the black man, and has some scenes where he terrorizes the commandant of the camp in a way. And also he finds his own strength and his own purpose in doing that. And then you've got a character like Jock McGrath, played by Jack Watson. Now, Jack Watson's an interesting character actor. Very craggy face. You'll recognize the face when you see him. Good, solid character actor. Played soldiers a lot. One of the reasons is that even though he does have had a background, his family were theatre people. He was actually a fitness instructor for the British Army during World War II. So he does present himself very well as a soldier, and has an interesting arc himself, as all the characters have got their own arcs. Roy Kinnear, in a role which could have been comic relief if it had been handled badly. His character, Monty Bartlett, could have been comic relief, and he is a bit of a joker in the pack in a sense, but there are aspects to the character which kind of give him more complexity than just an oaf would have in this kind of a film. And of course, the other character, Alfred Lynch, playing George Stevens, is a person who's never been in the army. He doesn't have the temperament for it. He doesn't have the mental toughness for it. And ultimately, things don't work out well for him during the arc of it. But Lynch is very good in the film. He shows that bewilderment it's not really a character weakness, it's just an inability to function in this particular environment his character has, which I find really interesting. And the other person of interest in the film is Ian Bannon, playing Staff Harris, who's a more humane prison guard. He's not soft on the men necessarily, but he does try to be fair, and he doesn't really agree with the regimental sergeant major's idea of breaking people to recreate them. And each of the main authority characters in this film, the regimental sergeant major, the characters played by Ian Hendry, Ian Bannon, Michael Redgrave, and Harry Andrews, all have different ideas on how prisons should be run, and they come into conflict with each other because of those different ideas, and because they really don't find a way to work together in order to do what they have to do here. And of course, there's no leadership above these guys, so it's a very Darwinian battle between the regimental sergeant major and his staff sergeants on how this place should be run and what's right and what's wrong in that particular context. And this film is brutal. There's a couple of point of view shots of people running up and down the hill, one of which is the character played by Alfred Lynch being forced to run up the hill while wearing a gas mask, where they cut between a kind of objective viewpoint and a point of view shot inside the mask to try to give you that claustrophobia combined with exhaustion. And most of it is that heavy breathing that he has to do to kind of breathe through this gas mask while performing incredibly strenuous exercise in very, very hot conditions. And it's really a deeply memorable film. And it's a memorable film for the fact that Connery's role is very unlike other roles. Even though A Fine Madness has him playing a mad poet, Connery plays an upright career soldier very well. It's not at all like James Bond, even though this movie was flanked by two James Bond films. It really is really unlike the Bond films, and the character he plays is very much unlike that. He's got a mustache. He's not in any way Bond-like. And I kind of like that too. I do like that fact that Connery, like I said before, the fact that Connery tried to do different things. In this one, he was very successful. The movie did win BAFTA awards. And the ensemble cast is just note perfect. They really do feel like the characters are inhabiting them. You forget that Connery is Connery in the film. And with somebody with his profile, particularly this part of his career, to have someone's acting carry you past that enormous and sometimes insurmountable barrier that you're watching Sean Connery instead of Roberts, the prisoner, is really, really interesting. And I do appreciate the role. I think it's a movie I'm not going to revisit very often because I do find it very brutal. I think that I will watch it again, but I'm going to leave a few years in between watching it so that I forget enough of it to be able to fully enjoy the experience again. You can get too familiar with movies at times, and they kind of, it dulls the edges of them for you. You know what's coming up. You know which bits are there. You know all the little nuances of them if you watch them too often. But in this case, I hadn't seen it since maybe the 1970s, and I meant to see it a number of times. It has been on television, but in this case, I'm glad I didn't, because I came at the movie almost fresh, and I really did appreciate doing that. And one of the interesting things that I find about this, I don't know if anybody else does, and bear with me if I'm going off the rails a bit here. It seems really interesting that Harry Andrews, who was very much a gentleman who liked gentlemen, played the role in the way that he did. He was gay, basically. And, of course, that comes out in one other movie he did, Entertaining Mr. Sloan, based on the Joe Orton play. But Harry Andrews in this one, there is a kind of undercurrent to the way he enjoys the company of other men, which I think Harry Andrews deliberately made as a choice to come in there. He derides other people's sexuality in subtle ways when he's talking about them. And I really do find that kind of interesting that somebody brings a real-life experience. And at the time, the law had only just changed to make being gay legal in England. Harry Andrews kind of bringing that... I mean, the Sergeant Major's happiest when he's making jokes with and about men. And he's got an almost sexual gleam in his eye when he's making jokes with all of the prisoners. Even though there's prison does get onto the edge of a riot, and he's there shouting up to get the attention of various guards who are positioned around the courtyard. And there's a really odd glee about the way that the RSM acts in this particular circumstance. He's right on the edge. He's in a very dangerous situation, but he's in control of it, he thinks, and there are some events later on that prove that he's not. But there's a kind of edgy glee that he has, which is really, in a weird way, sexually charged. So that's all I want to say about The Hill. I think it's a movie that you should watch. It does have those magnificent bastards in it. And it's a really fine piece of British/American filmmaking. Lumet, of course, being an American director and who later worked again with Connery on a couple of occasions. But Lumet, who had originally been in television, in this film really does a fine job of giving you a strong sense of the heat, the dust, the contained boiling, you know, melting pot of people that the prison camp in the hill really does have. So that's about it about that. I'm going to take a break, and when I come back, I'm going to give a bit of feedback and let you know what's going to happen next fortnight when we do the Martian Drive-In podcast one more time.
Que j'aime voir, chère indolente, de ton corps si beau, comme une étoffe vacillante miroiter la peau. Sur ta chevelure profonde, aux acres parfums, mer odorante et vagabonde, aux flots bleus et bruns, comme un navire qui s'éveille au vent du matin, mon âme rêveuse appareille pour un ciel lointain. Tes yeux où rien ne se révèle, de doux ni d'amère, sont de bijoux froids où se mêle l'or avec le fer. À te voir marcher en cadence, belle d'abandon, on dirait un serpent qui danse au bout d'un bâton. Sous le fardeau de ta paresse, ta tête d'enfant se balance avec la mollesse d'un jeune éléphant. Et ton corps se penche et s'allonge comme un fin vaisseau qui roule bord sur bord et plonge ses vergues dans l'eau. Comme un flot grossi par la fonte des glaciers grondants, quand l'eau de ta bouche remonte au bord de tes dents, je crois boire un vin de bohème amer et vainqueur, un ciel liquide qui parsème d'étoiles mon cœur.
That, of course, was the immortal Serge Gainsbourg doing Baudelaire, which is an incredibly cool track from his 1960s period before he got drug-fucked and alcoholic. So, on with some feedback, and I do have a little bit. I really would like to get more voicemails if I could, so you can go to the voicemail number which was announced at the top of the show and send them. Just give me a moment to get my voicemail. I got one from Joey Hambrick. It's an email and it says, I've been listening to the podcast for a few years now, and I'm sure you get this constantly, but your dulcet tones have kept me from going insane during the endless slog that is my day job. Anyway, I really enjoyed your episode on Nightmare Alley because your point of view was new to me regarding what I would consider a disturbingly American film. I produce a show for two people who know far more about the stuff than I, the Forgotten Horrors podcast. So I'm going to put a link in the show notes and in This is me talking. I'm going to put a link in the show notes and in the podcast blog for that. Your take on this particular film led us to cover it as well. Since I only manage the levels and put this stuff online, I don't feel that I'm bragging to say that I think the conversation makes a great supplement to your insights. I hope you'll forgive me for my podcast thievery. Keep up the great work so that I can remain employed. Joey. Thanks for that, Joey. That's the whole idea, is to share the love of this stuff. And it sounds like your friends over at the Forgotten Horrors podcast are playing the same side of the street as me, but it's a very wide street and there's plenty of room on the pavement. So it is nice to know that I can kind of pass that on for other people to use in what they do as well. I don't get precious about this, though. I think all podcasters get a little bit where you've covered a movie and then somebody you know, a friend who podcasts, then covers the same movie a year or two later. And you kind of get a sense of ownership about it. But I think that's human nature. It's not to be taken particularly seriously. But please, I'm glad you're enjoying it. And as for keeping you sane, you must have a shit job, mate, because if my voice keeps people sane, then maybe you need to change employment. on your day job. I don't know you well enough to say that, but I'm going to say it anyway. So let's have a look and see what else I've got as far as comments are concerned. I didn't get any other feedback, but I did get a really cool link by my friend Robin Penn over in Perth, who hit me to the fact that there's an enormous movie poster auction in Australia this week where they're selling it all as one lot. And the asking price is around $2 million. They have a 4-sheet French original King Kong poster, mint condition, only one of its kind in the world, amongst other things. They have movie posters for classic Australian films like The Overlanders with Chips Rafferty. I just saw a bit about it on ABC News through the link that Robin sent. And I'm really glad that I collected movie posters after that. If you can get in on the grassroots of collecting movie posters, please do. A lot of the artwork isn't what it used to be. But if you can, for not too many bucks, you can go out there and find older movie posters, anywhere back 50 years old, for a fairly good price. So if you're all interested in that, I recommend it as a hobby. I've now got 44 day bill posters, which isn't a lot compared to some other people, but I kind of like the ones I've got. My suggestion for that would be go with the movies you like, but try to find unusual posters about those movies. In fact, one of the rarest Daybill posters at the moment is a Halloween poster in Australian Daybill form, because it's the only original Halloween poster that shows a picture of Michael Myers on it. And amongst collectors, it's enormous. The other thing to look for is classic, anything to do with classic 1950s science fiction, even the kind of crude lithograph ones that we have in Australia, are worth a hell of a lot of money. They're selling for hundreds of bucks each. So I'm going to try to save up and pick up one or two of those as investments, but that's about it. So I'm waffling now. It's time for me to shuffle off. Before I do, I'm going to let you know what's happening with the Martian Drive-In podcast next time around. The Martian Drive-In, by the way, will be getting its own RSS feed within a month. I'm going to keep it as a part of the Paleo Cinema RSS feed as well, so you'll be able to get them both just by subscribing to Paleo Cinema, or you can go to the specific Martian Drive-In podcast RSS feed, which will be up in iTunes once I get the RSS feed going and the hosting as a separate thing. That's all kind of technical podcasting in talk, but it basically means in a month or two you'll be able to search for the Martian Drive-In podcast on iTunes and subscribe to it through there. So that's about it this time. I've already actually got the next Martian Drive-In podcast in the can waiting for feedback on the previous one, which is a hint, by the way. The two movies I'm doing are a 2007 film called The Man from Earth and a 2002 film directed by Vincenzo Natali, who directed Splice, called Cypher, which has Jeremy Northam and Lucy Liu in it. So I'm going a little bit different with the Martian Drive-In ones. And I do have a couple of guests on. My friends Grant and Sonia are there, and we're shooting the shit. We talk about all sorts of weird things apart from the movies, breast implants and why Nicole Kidman's forehead doesn't move and all sorts of other stuff like that. So it's a pretty good little effort. And having said that, I'm going to go now. So enjoy your movie watching. Everyone stay cool. I hope only good things happen to you. And if they don't, I hope the bad ones are very short-lived and small. And I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with the Martian Drive-In podcast, and in 4 weeks' time with Paleo Cinema Podcast 105. See you later.